Coming up, got Matt Harmon from Yahoo Sports talking fantasy football, getting some advice from him if you're trying to plan for your fantasy football draft later this month. And then later, got a special appearance from my friend Iron. We're talking Battlefield 6, Call of Duty, and a little bit of NBA as well. That's all coming up right now. You can now watch The Kevin O'Connor Show on Yahoo Sports Network, our first ever streaming TV channel. The Yahoo Sports Network is available to stream on all leading FAST services. We're also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, where you can catch all of the shows on your phone or your browser. Let's talk some fantasy football. And to do that, Matt Harmon from Yahoo Sports. Matt, what's going on, man?
Kevin, I appreciate being here, man. It is, I keep just feeling more and more like mix of not anxiety, but just that feeling of like something is coming, because week one is like right. It is just rapidly approaching. Every time I look at the calendar, it's getting closer and closer. But I love this time of year. I'm definitely ready for the actual damn games to start, but I still love talking about this stuff right here before week one really gets rolling.
It's definitely a good time of year. It's always fun, the speculation and all that, until things become real. And that's what we're going to talk about right now. Some of the stuff that's on my mind as I'm trying to get back into the NFL this year, because I spent some time away focusing entirely on NBA, NFL, back in LA. I was living there, wasn't watching games on Sunday. Now I'm back in Mass, trying to get back into being a Patriots fan again, trying to get back into being an NFL fan again. It is a good time. So I rejoined my friend's fantasy football league, my high school friends, a league that I originally started back in like 08 or 09. And that's part of it. Fantasy football is a big part of it. So I'm thinking about fantasy right now, Matt. And I noticed with our Yahoo Sports fantasy rankings, everybody has Joe Burrow ranked as the QB5. But you have him ranked the highest on your board at 39th, sitting just a little bit behind Jalen Hurts. What is the logic behind kind of having Burrow similar to that top four, clear-cut top four group? Is he, in your mind, a guy that maybe could be a QB1 potential if the Bengals' defense is so bad, the Bengals are having a score of 60 points a game? What's the logic behind Burrow kind of in that spot, closer to that group, rather than some of the other guys in lower tiers?
Sure. So I think with the quarterback position, I've really come around from being kind of like a hardened, true late round quarterback bro for the most part of like my time playing fantasy football, because like, okay, there's just not that much difference between the guys at the top and the guys at the bottom of the position. But that has really changed over the last few years. And for the most part, it's these hyper mobile, but also super efficient passers. Your Lamar Jacksons, your Josh Allen, your Jaden Daniels. When we get to the third round of fantasy drafts, like I kind of think the third round is pretty weak this year. You know, there are, the wide receiver picks are dicey. The running backs there are like Amarian Hampton, Kyron Williams. Those guys are kind of my favorite picks in the third round among running backs, but they're not flawless bets either. So typically, like I Jaden Daniels is the last guy in that first tier. I end up taking him a lot. But that second tier, which to me is a two-man tier, and you mentioned, is Jalen Hurts and it's Joe Burrow. I still like taking those guys ahead of some of the more dicey picks at the running back and wide receiver position before we really get into an interesting area of the draft, which I know we'll talk about later. And to me, if you're going to be, you know, Joe Burrow, obviously he can move a little bit. He's had some rushing ability throughout the course of his career, but he's still more so a true pocket quarterback than those other four players that we just talked about. If you're going to be that guy and you're going to have QB1 overall upside, it has to be in the right ecosystem, in the right environment, part of which is, as you mentioned, that defense is going to force them into pass-first game scripts. We saw that last year. I know it's just preseason, but based on the preseason so far, doesn't look like that got any better over the course of the offseason. And you're also going to need to be in a unique offensive environment as well, which certainly is true with all of the weapons coming back in Cincinnati, Jamar Chase, T. Higgins. So yeah, if I miss out on the early tier of quarterbacks and I still want to lock that position in, I do think Joe Burrow is a top 40 pick. He has QB1 upside for sure.
Interesting. So I think with Burrow, that's one of the things that's been on my mind lately. When do I want to go QB? Because I think this year there's still a lot of guys. Like, as a Patriots fan, like, I think Drake May should have a better year. Yeah. If you do miss out on those top guys, there are a number of different options you can go to later in the draft. But it seems like you think with Burrow, he's kind of head and shoulders above some of those guys, where he'd be worth taking in a round three or round four over some of the wide receivers, running backs in that range, because maybe with them, you're getting more equal value in rounds five, six, seven, eight, rather than quarterback, where you do feel like Burrow just offers higher upside.
Yeah. So for me and my kind of like picks 34 to like 40 range, I mentioned Kyren Williams, Amarian Hampton. I do think there's like a tier breakdown to guys that are true fourth round picks, but players I would take ahead of Joe Burrow. Kenneth Walker in Seattle, I think, is a guy that, as long as he stays healthy, he has a high ceiling this year, man. He's a natural fit in this outside zone run scheme, and he's just been a proven producer again when he's been on the field. I don't mind taking Zach Charbonnet, the backup, later, and I actually think that Charbonnet might have some standalone value as well. I love taking those type of backs that might have a little bit of standalone value but also have great contingent upside. So Charbonnet is a great pick later. Alvin Kamara, Chuba Hubbard also are two guys I like taking in this range, but then I think there's another drop off to the next group of running backs, and certainly the Terry McLaurin, Tyreek Hill, Garrett Wilson tier of wide receivers that I would probably just rather secure Burrow there. But once Burrow goes off the board, man, like, we're talking about quarterbacks structurally this year, I don't have another quarterback inside my top 75 picks, because I think from QB6 all the way down to like QB17, it's extremely flat. So yeah, like, Pat Mahomes is my QB6. You know, Kyler Murray's up in that range. I typically end up just waiting and grabbing the Drake Mays or even Brock Purdy, those guys later on that I think offer very similar floor to ceiling projections, but just go much later in drafts.
With Mahomes, you have him as your QB6. Has the time passed for him being a QB1, QB2? Is that, like, there's no hope of him being like the steal?
I mean, there's always hope because he's really good. You know, he might be the best quarterback in the. Yeah, like, he's that it's such stupid analysis, but like, yeah, he's Patrick Mahomes. Like, that's always on the table. And I do think that the drafting and apparently just immediate insertion to the starting lineup of Josh Simmons could end up being a huge deal. Because really, if Pat Mahomes is going to get back to being that like quarterback one in fantasy, and that's why I still want to have him ranked the highest of this tier, it's going to be because him and Xavier Worthy just connect on more of those deep shots. And some of that was on Worthy. Honestly, some of that is on Patrick Mahomes. And I think Mahomes is a guy that you can tell gets really uncomfortable, which, I mean, shoot, I don't blame him. I'd be uncomfortable too with all those guys coming after me. Like, when there's issues at tackle, there's pressure off the edge. So if Simmons is locking that left tackle position down and Mahomes just has a half a second longer to set his feet and let it rip accurately down the field to Xavier Worthy, who certainly can get open on those vertical routes, like, that's how he gets back to being that guy. But I just look at the construction of this offense right now with Rashee Rice going to be suspended at some point, Travis Kelce on the decline. I'm just not sure that they have enough. Like, it's enough to win a Super Bowl, which is the real ultimate goal. But is it enough for him to be like a difference maker in fantasy? That's where I'm a little skeptical.
You mentioned Xavier Worthy. He, of course, went viral last week with the New Heights interview with Taylor Swift, her mentioning him by name, as one of a wide receiver sleepers. And I listened to your podcast, Yahoo Fantasy Forecast. You guys just launched Yahoo Fantasy Football YouTube channel, growing fast. Cool to see everything you guys are doing up there now on its own channel if people want to check that out. And you guys had a recent episode about wide receivers. And one of the themes of that conversation, like, aside from Jamar Chase and the top targets in first, second round, you said rounds five to eight are the real sweet spot for wide receivers this year. And so I want to go through some categories of like the wide receivers in that general range, starting with, like, who do you think is the surest thing in that round 5 to 8 range for wide receivers?
Yeah. And again, it is an awesome group of players. One that, you know, like, I'm writing up my favorite pick in every round piece right now. And, you know, I did the classic hedge thing where, like, yeah, in round 7, I mean, I like this guy, that. But my favorite pick, you know, so just like, let's get all the names, like, out there, because like
8 honorable mentions. It's like, wait, this is the whole round.
Correct. Yeah, the classic, like, yeah, well, I really do love, because it's a great,
like,
area.
NBA award voting's like that. It's like all NBA, and your honorable mentions at the end. It's like 15 names and then 20 more honorable mentions. It's like, okay, let's just, you don't need to list all of them.
Yeah, it's the cover your ass section of whatever you're doing, right? Like, yes. See, you guys can't get mad at me because I did give him an honorable mention. Like, yeah, it wasn't top 10, but it's an honorable mention. Close enough, right? I mean, that is just, that's classic sports media stuff right there for the people watching and listening. But yeah, no, I think the surest bet kind of in that range is like Devontae Smith, who I have at wide receiver 24, which Devontae Smith is number one, damn good player. Excellent wide receiver. I think really was kind of maximized last year as more of an interior receiver. He's a guy that can win from all three alignments. He's somebody who could play X even at a smaller size because he's historically been in reception perception, which is my charting methodology for wide receivers. We can get into that in a bit, but like he's always been great against press coverage, like even because he's such a good, strong technician. He plays bigger than his size. But last year he took a career high reps from the slot, and that really, again, I think made him from an efficiency standpoint very, very good. Now, I think we are over-indexing on what the Eagles were last year, and they should still have a really good run game and a real good defense this year, but let's say they are the fifth best run game in the NFL, or they're the eighth best defense as opposed to number one in the league. Like, that's just going to be more passing volume to this Eagles offense, and I think, like, you take Devontae Smith, you know what you're getting. You're getting really good wide receiver two production. But there is, he's one of those rare wide receivers that has contingent upside. If AJ Brown, who, like, I love AJ Brown, knock on wood, he is dealing with a hamstring injury right now. If he misses games, Devontae Smith then probably will be ranked as a wide receiver one in fantasy. So, like, he's a sure bet. It's very safe floor player, but somebody that I also think you can imagine high upside if Brown misses time.
What do you think about the philosophy of pairing quarterback and wide receiver or pairing quarterback and tight end? Like, if I draft Jalen Hurts early in my draft, do I want to take Smith in the 5-8 range, or do I want to look elsewhere to diversify my roster?
I think if you're doing, you know, these like larger field best ball tournaments, then that really does matter because you're trying to beat out a wide field of players. But you have to nail the exact right offense. I always come back to those 2013 Denver Broncos. It's like, oh, who won your league that year? It was whoever got like Peyton Manning and multiple of his pass catchers when he broke records as a passer. So if you land on that type of environment, I think you can absolutely like go for that strategy because you're just going to be a really tough team to beat. But I don't think it's necessary. Like, I wouldn't go out of my way to take Devontae Smith like a whole round ahead of ADP because I think Eagles offense can be really good, but I don't know that they have like that.
Would I even drop him on my own board if I'm getting Jalen Hurts? Like, I would not raise him, but would I perhaps want to go elsewhere?
No, I wouldn't try to think about it too much like that. Like, again, I just like, just make the best pick on the board is really the right way to go about it. So it's one thing to me, like if it's in one of those like larger field best ball tournaments, I think you could do that. But to me, I just think in a typical redraft league, like this tier is so big that I wouldn't necessarily, like, if you want to go that way, like, I wouldn't fight you if you took a couple wide receivers ahead of him. But to me, I do think he just projects so well that I wouldn't try to like overthink it in that way.
All right. So for some of those other wide receivers, who do you think is the biggest boomer bust wide receiver in this range?
Yeah, I think it's Rome Odunze, Bears wide receiver, who goes like towards the back half in this range. But I will just fully admit that I'm a big Rome Odunze fan. I thought he was an awesome prospect. I thought he was right up there with the Marvin Harrison Juniors, the Malik Nabers in last year's 2024 draft. I thought he was such a detailed technician, a guy who really just dominated against press man coverage and seemed like a natural fit at the X receiver spot for the Chicago Bears, which is exactly what did not happen in the 2024 Bears offense. He ended up being a guy that kind of moved around the formation, didn't really have like, there were not a lot of clear roles in that 2024 Bears wide receiver room. And then the entire offense was a disastrous environment. I'm pretty much willing to give guys like Rome and Caleb Williams, these younger players in Chicago's offense, a little bit of a pass for what we saw last year from a statistics perspective, because it was clearly just like a rotten to the core environment. But coming in with Ben Johnson, I think, again, fresh start here. He seems like the type of guy that Ben Johnson is going to really gravitate to. He's right and tight on the details, which is what a if you've paid attention to Ben Johnson at all as the Bears head coach, you can tell that he's very demanding on those players. We actually had Rome on the Yahoo Fantasy Forecast, and he talked about, yeah, he has been hard on us. He's been demanding about the details, but he's like, this is the type of guy I am. Like, I love that that style of coaching. So I think, like, more role clarity for a guy like Adunze, the ceiling is really there. If Caleb takes to this offense, if the Bears finally get, like, stuck out of the mud from an offensive perspective, which it might not happen right away, right? Like, this unit, I know they dominated in preseason, but they might come out a little slow out of the gate as they're paring things down, finding what works for these players. But overall, in the back half of the season, I think this offense could really hit. But Adunze is just, like, a talent bet to me that I really like. But you do also have to acknowledge that it's crowded in this offense. DJ Moore is still there. We'll see what his role becomes under Ben Johnson. They drafted Luther Burden in the second round. Luther Burden is a very talented player who I think needs hard coaching and is going to get it here. They have two tight ends they want to get in the mix. So it's not as if, like, oh, you can just pencil in Adunze for 130 targets and really look for that boom. There's a way that he just kind of becomes a solid wide receiver three, and you're maybe slightly disappointed if you reached on him ahead of ADP.
That makes total sense. So with him, it's not really a question of talent and offense with Ben Johnson being as talented as he is. It's more so just a matter of targets and the share of opportunity he gets within that offense. So you mentioned him. He's entering his second year in the NFL. Who's, like, the best rookie swing in that range? Is there a rookie wide receiver in rounds 5 to 8 that people should be thinking about?
Yeah, there's two of them, really. It's Tetero McMillan and then Travis Hunter. I'll talk about Travis Hunter because I think he's just slightly more interesting. Like, I like Tet where he goes, but or T-Mac where he goes, but Hunter is a, to me, special wide receiver prospect. Like, I don't watch a lot of college football. I mean, I know who Travis Hunter is, obviously, but, you know, Kevin, you and I were talking before the show. I'm a happily married man. I'm trying to stay a happily married man. It would be tough to sell my wife on, hey, football basically dominates our life, you know, 365 days of the year mostly, but especially during the season, pretty much every day. But I got a whole nother day here on Saturday where I'm going to be locked into football. That would be a tough sell. That would be a tough sell to the wife. So I don't watch a lot of college football, but again, I knew who Travis Hunter was as, like, a two-way player. So I go back, you know, all the way back in February when I'm going to start charting wide receiver prospects for reception perception. I'm like, well, we'll see how good this guy is actually at wide receiver. He certainly is raw as a technician, which you'd expect because he did not spend almost any time in offensive meetings in Colorado, which is crazy, by the way, that's he was as good as he is as a wide receiver, and he wasn't even really practicing or spending time at the position. But you just look at him, he's so explosive. 97th percentile success rate versus zone coverage and reception perception, 97th against press, 92nd against man coverage. Even if he's not perfectly detailed as a route runner, he is an elite separator because he's so explosive, and when he is right on the details, he's an impossible cover. Great with the ball in his hands, rare catching and tracking ability. Like, again, that looks like an elite wide receiver prospect to me. And he gets drafted by Jacksonville. They trade up for him. It's been pretty clear for a while they want him to be an offensive first player, and I just love the way he was in preseason, glimpses we got of him in that first game, in the slot, off the line of scrimmage, in motion, getting layup targets. The Bucs last year under Liam Cohen were the best screen team, and they were great at creating opportunities in space for their wide receivers. I think Hunter just profiles really well as a guy that can win in that way. So if you're taking, like, I mean, it's a big swing, and, you know, I know some people are scared that, oh, he's gonna be more of a cornerback. I think he will play on defense, no question about it, but he's going to be a near full-time player on offense on passing downs. And to me, in this range where he goes, like in this picks, you know, kind of 76 range, I'm more than willing to take that swing on him there.
I Googled his name while we were chatting, and the first thing that popped up was a Yahoo Sports article about Travis Hunter's divorce already. You just said you're happily married. I mean, I hope already. Jeez, God, everybody saw that coming, I guess. Or so. Travis Hunter. Yeah. That's true.
More time to focus on football, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes, more time to focus on football. So, yeah, maybe he moves up a little bit in rankings there. But, well, Travis Hunter, definitely talented. I mean, look, I think anytime you have, like, either multi-sport athletes or multi-position athletes, they're just fun. Like, they're fun players. I think it's going to be cool to see a guy hopefully play both sides of the ball. So Travis Hunter, I'll keep him in mind in that range. Who's the boring but reliable veteran in rounds 5 to 8 as a wide receiver people should be thinking about?
I think it's Calvin Ridley here. And it's taken a while for his ADP to actually get on the rise because I think people just look at the Tennessee Titans offense. They were terrible last year. They drafted first in the NFL draft for a reason. They were not a good team last year. But I think Ridley, because we just kind of crossed the Titans off last year, and honestly, like, I feel for Titans fans, man. They have the first pick in the draft, and still nobody talks about this team. Like, nobody talks about the Tennessee Titans. They might be the most overlooked team in the entire NFL. But again, like, people did not realize that Calvin Ridley, in that poisoned offensive environment last year, had 1,000 yards. He was top 10 in yards per route run against man coverage. Like, he was super productive. And again, charting him last year for reception perception, he was somebody that really took a big step forward in his second year back from a long absence away from the NFL. You know, he's away from the game, a year-long suspension for gambling. He took about a half season off with the Atlanta Falcons in his last year there. For mental health reasons, which he's been public about and open about. So his first year back with the Jaguars in 23, he was definitely volatile, but he was much more of like a steady, consistent wide receiver last year on film. And now he's getting a quarterback that, look, Cam Ward's a rookie. We don't totally know what we're going to get there, but he's been super complimentary of Ridley as like clearly his guy. So I just think people probably are just going to completely look away from his name, but he's been ranked outside the top 30 receivers for most of the offseason. I have him closer to wide receiver 23, somebody I would be perfectly comfortable relying on as a wide receiver 2. And if you can get him as a 3, I think there's both a good ceiling and floor projection there.
You mentioned reception perception. How is Calvin Ridley's route tree a match with Cam Ward? Like, is Cam Ward as a rookie quarterback a good fit with Calvin Ridley?
I'm so glad that you asked this, because this is one of the things that has really hammered home how good of a pick Calvin Ridley is this year to me. Because if you think about like how Ridley, again, was productive last year with Will Levis, it was mostly just on these deep shot plays, because that's how Will Levis really wants to play. He wants to push that ball down the field, and there's not a lot in terms of the short underneath kind of base boring routes. And this is why I think Ridley projects better from a floor perspective this year, because Cam Ward, some of the routes that he's best at throwing are these like intermediate routes over the middle of the field, the shorter routes like slants and digs, stuff like that. He's good at layering those passes. He's got good touch and timing and accuracy working over that middle of the field. And he's aggressive enough to drill it in over zone coverage. And when you look at Ridley last year, 86.1% success rate on slants. And that's just like him getting open. That's not getting targets, production, any of that. 86.8 on digs. Not a lot of targets, not a lot of accurate footballs on those two routes last year. I think that is going to change with Cam Ward under center.
Interesting. I like it. I've enjoyed Cam Ward's quotes. It seems to have a good head on his shoulders. I see why the Titans invested in him with the number one pick. Seems to have the right mindset. Calvin Ridley, interesting with him, because I rejoined my friend's fantasy football league and I'm inheriting a team because they're doing keepers. So okay. I get one keeper. After I think round 4 or round 5, and the two options in my mind are James Cook, Bills running back, as a 5th round keeper, or Calvin Ridley as an 8th round keeper, and the league is full PPR. I'm leaning towards James Cook in that range. Round 5 feels like good value. However, the fact it's full PPR, the fact James Cook has a potential handcuff behind him and Zay Davis, who could be getting a lot of opportunities, I'm still strongly considering Ridley as round 8 as my keeper and then going elsewhere in round 5 instead of James Cook. But I'm leaning towards Cook at this moment. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like, when you do fantasy football stuff, you have to have like a thought on every player. And I just feel like I don't have like a strong feeling on James Cook. You know, I definitely realize that the touchdowns that he scored last year are probably not repeatable. Right. Like, I don't think he's gonna, there's some regression coming there, both because, as you mentioned, like, Ray Davis is a good back. They also love Ty Johnson. Josh Allen loves Ty Johnson. He's called him like the best third down back in the league. So like, James Cook is a guy who definitely can be, I mean, is the starting back, and he's the guy there. They just paid him, obviously, as we're showing on screen right now. Like, they believe in James Cook. But also, Josh Allen's always going to steal goal line carries away as well. So I think those touchdowns are not really repeatable this year. But is he going to just outright bust as a probably more so of a 3rd, 4th round pick? So you are getting him at a value as a 5th. And I have him ranked 40th overall. So I think, like, he's a guy that you're probably, if you're coming up at bat and you're swinging at James Cook, I don't know that you're going to hit a home run as the 40th overall pick, but I think you definitely get on base with him. Ridley, though, in round 8, like, I've got him ranked 50th overall. So there's definitely a big gap to where I have Ridley, to where kind of the industry has Ridley. And then certainly, you know, you're keeping the eighth round there. Who else is getting kept in this league? Like, are there going to be a lot of running backs available? Because there is definitely a drop off in my running back rankings from a certainty perspective once we get out of that top 18 players to position. I think with wide receiver, as much as I like Ridley, like, dude, we're talking about this rounds 5 to 8 range. I could sit here and rattle off like 15 names that I like in this range. So I would probably just end up keeping James Cook now that we've talked this out in like a therapy session.
For sure. I mean, I think that's where I'm leaning here. And you're right. It does depend a lot on what others do with their keepers as well, with what you decide to do. But ultimately, I think James Cook, there's a safety, even if he only runs for 900 yards and only 8 touchdowns. I mean, I'd be disappointed spending round 5 on him. But there's a level of reliability that you feel like you're going to get from him. This week, Brian Robinson Jr. being shopped in trade talks. Who is the rookie running back behind him? Is he worth spending a pick on? Tell me about the situation, Matt.
Yeah, Bill Krosky Merritt, or Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt, a 7th round pick is apparently enough for them. And they also really like Chris Rodriguez, and obviously Austin Ekeler is still there too. So it just feels like Brian Robinson
Austin
Jr.
Ekeler. I know that name, Austin Ekeler. That's a name that I know. But he's now not even clear-cut starter. He's fallen off at this point.
I know. It feels kind of funny. This is class. I used to host a show with Austin Ekeler, and I would always tell him about the life cycle of a fantasy football running back. I was like, let me tell you what, buddy. Like, see, you, because he perfectly encapsulates this. When Austin came onto the scene with the Los Angeles Chargers, you know, they still had Melvin Gordon there, and obviously at that point it was like, get Melvin Gordon. Melvin Gordon's a former first round pick who was like an instant hit in fantasy leagues. It's like, oh yeah. Like Melvin Gordon, I'm drafting that guy, rookie first round pick, whatever, ends up being a pretty productive guy. Then Austin comes on the scene. He's like more efficient. He's like a more explosive rusher. People are like, get Melvin Gordon out of here. I'm trying to see Austin Ekeler. And then obviously Ekeler goes on a great run. He was like the running back 1 overall in multiple seasons for fantasy. And now he's like the old guy that people don't even talk about. We're like, yeah, look at Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt or whatever. So I'm like, this is the life cycle of a fantasy running back. But I still think there's decent value in taking Ekeler as a late round pick. You know, he's a passing down guy, and this is still like, this is an offense, Kevin, that Nate Tice and I are doing a show about this that's going to be live today at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday. You can find it wherever you get your podcast too. But like, we're looking at offenses that have we're more so trying to look at the disappointing players, and I promise I'm going to answer your question here in a second. But like looking at these offenses that are projected to be really highly scoring offenses from multiple sources, which the Commanders certainly are, but nobody really wants to take any of their players. Which is to me just why Jaden Daniels is such a great pick. But if the Commanders' offense is going to be great again this year, you know, we have to like put some priority on some of these running back picks. Like, so Ekeler is a late round draft pick. Bill Krosky Merritt, who does look like him and kind of Chris Rodriguez, like I said, a guy that they like. I don't want to just overlook him. And he was good in the preseason last night as well. Those guys might split like the early down banger work, which does leave Ekeler to take some early down work, but also inherit passing down work as well. And obviously with a scrambling quarterback, you're not going to catch as many passes. But to me, I do think all of those guys are worth targeting in the late rounds. I would probably rank it Bill Krosky Merritt, just because, again, younger guy, explosive. He's going to get the early down running work, most likely over Rodriguez. Then I think it's Ekeler. Then Rodriguez is more like a deeper league kind of look at. If anything happens here injury-wise, maybe somebody you're running to the waiver wire for.
I know you wouldn't be spending like a first or second round pick on Krosky Merritt or really any of these rookie running backs aside from Travion Henderson with my Patriots. But I think I've been burned so many times in the past with rookie running backs, banking on them being the star guy. I mean, I was a dummy who took Trent Richardson in the first round many years ago. I've seen Clyde Edwards-Helaire, all these backs the years that people are like, oh yeah, they're going to be big this year. And I've been burned on rookie running backs. So with this year though, where's the level of certainty? Have things changed with rookie running backs, Matt, in the time, like the last 4 or 5 years that I haven't really been watching a lot of NFL? Cause it feels like there's a lot of them being mentioned as quality picks this year in fantasy football.
Well, you're definitely forgetting the biggest fish of them all, which is Ashton Jeanty with the Raiders. And it's like, it's easy to forget him just because he's just been locked in as a first round fantasy pick since the moment he was, frankly, like before he was drafted.
That's the fear, man. You
know? And it's funny you mentioned Trent Richardson because I actually made that comparison of how things can go poorly for Ashton Jeanty and the Raiders.
I just want to do it. I want to do it.
Here's the thing. Like I mentioned that show that Nate and I are going to do. The offense that has the biggest disparity with how high their players are going and how, again, from like multiple sources, you know, Aaron Schatz at DVOA, Mike Clay, like Vegas scoring projections. The offense with the biggest disparity between how high their players are going and how much the offense is projected to score is easily the Las Vegas Raiders because,
wow,
like Brock Bowers is a locked in second round pick. Ashton Jeanty is a locked in first round pick. And I can't find a source that expects the Raiders to be anything better than like the 20th best offense in the NFL. Vegas has them scoring the 27th most points per game. And like, obviously those projections can be wrong, of course, but it's just, man, that's a big leap of faith to kind of us. And Jacoby Myers is even a guy that he fits into that like rounds 5 to 8 range of a guy that's a pretty rock solid veteran that people are taking around the 90th overall selection. So either the industry is way wrong about the Raiders or one of those two players, Ashton Jeanty, Brock Bowers, is going to likely disappoint as a first or second round pick. Overall, I don't mind taking rookie running backs when you get them at like a nice discount. Jeanty's a guy that I have kind of struggled with as a clear first round pick, but you're ticking off other names. He does kind of stand out from a volume perspective there. That's how much he's going to touch the football and how much I do expect them to want to be run heavy. But shoot, like, yeah, Travion Henderson with the Patriots is rocketing up draft boards. Marian Hampton with the Chargers is a guy that with Najee Harris, you know, dealing with this eye injury, he has not practiced at all with the team after that July 4th fireworks incident. He looks like he's going to moonwalk into a starting job. So the thing I would say, Kevin, if you are taking these rookie running backs, and this is also true with rookies at the wide receiver position, you got to be ready to be a little patient. Like you can't, like let's say RJ Harvey with the Denver Broncos, he goes out there and like J.K. Dobbins is just out snapping, outworking him early on in the season. In September, he's getting that veteran deference. You've got to be able to just sit there and like say, hey, took RJ Harvey for the back half of the year. Like that's when he's really gonna, you know, really get rolling. So sometimes honestly, it's not who drafts the rookies. It's who ends up picking them up off the waiver wire when somebody in your league got a little impatient and dropped them.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes that's the gamble. And obviously waiting for guys on waivers is a risk as well. But before I let you go, Matt, I got to point out, we both have an album behind our head, Hotel California by the Eagles. We both have it over our shoulders. You have it over your right shoulder. I have it over mine as well, right here. Crazy.
You notice that. Yeah.
Wild.
Well, they actually set this like home background up when I was living in LA and I had to try to recreate it here. The number one comment I always get is like, why don't you change the records out enough? And I'm like, because, buddy, like I'm not thinking about what's behind me for the most part. I'm on camera every damn day of my life. The last thing I'm thinking about is these records, but I did like, all right, we'll do it for the 2025 season. I'm doing a refresh. And for some reason I went like all three, just black. I've got Dawes here over my left shoulder. I've got Alabama Shakes here over my head.
Oh, nice.
And then I was like, well, Hotel California, I need something a little more throwback. And that definitely fit kind of in the theme there as well.
It looks nice. I'm currently learning the solo Hotel California. So I'm going to learn a Led Zeppelin solo. I'm going to learn the Eagles solo as well. So I got those over my shoulders for a little bit of inspiration.
There we go.
But yeah, classic. Did you see him at Sphere by any chance? The Eagles?
No, I didn't.
That was sensational. It was a great time. Matt,
oh, yeah, that's awesome.
We can all find your stuff at Yahoo Fantasy Forecast on any audio platform. You just launched the Yahoo Fantasy Football YouTube channel. Been awesome to see everything going up there. You're crushing it, Matt. Thank you so much for joining me today, man. And we'll be right back after this break. All right, got a special guest joining me today, an old friend, Iron, Call of Duty, Warzone, Battlefield 6, Battle Royale extraordinaire streamer, Iron. How you doing, man?
Good to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me. I'm stoked for this.
Appreciate you joining me, man. We've been friends for like 4 years now. You were really one of the people that got me back into playing Warzone, playing Call of Duty, getting back into streaming. You're the first streamer I really watched. It was you, then I think Breadman, and then starting watching Big Bob and Rallied, among others. And yeah, appreciate you getting me back into it, Iron. This past weekend, the past 2 weekends, Battlefield 6 came out with their beta. You were playing the hell out of that on your stream. So I want to talk about some of your first impressions of the Battlefield 6 beta. Tell me, how happy are you playing this game? What are your first impressions playing it?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I've been a Call of Duty Warzone player for, what, 4 years now, 5 years? And it started really, really well with the Modern Warfare 2019. They made a phenomenal game, and it's been kind of downhill for a few years. It's been a tough few. As far as playing video games go for a living, it's been a tough few years. You can put it into context there. But Battlefield 6, it feels like they put their soul into it. It's probably the best way to say it. You can just tell that everything was so well thought out, and the bones of the game are phenomenal. So it's going to be very difficult for them to screw up a battle royale. As far as Battlefield 6 goes, just create a more closer to PUBG, farther from Warzone type BR. The farther away from a one life game mode you get, the less interested I feel like a lot of players become, because that intensity that builds into the end game just dwindles if you can just die and get bought back 100 times like COD's current state. So, but the bare bones of the game are unreal. The immersiveness of Battlefield 6 is unlike anything I've ever played, really. It's a movie. I remember like playing that game, both weekends, really, but the first weekend, running down the street, bullets are whizzing over your head, the sounds are amazing, buildings are blowing up behind you, tanks, artillery's flying over your head, you're throwing smokes, diving on the ground. It's like, this game's a movie, man. It's unbelievable. So I'm very excited about the game. Future of it, and the battle royale especially.
You mentioned the audio. I think that's one of the things I'm most encouraged by playing it, because coming from Warzone, where it feels like I'm deaf and I can't hear footsteps right next to me, and then I go to Battlefield and it's like, oh wait a minute, there are planes and bombs and buildings crashing and I can still hear footsteps.
Yeah, right. It tried. Crazy.
Aside from the audio being quite good so far in the beta, what does have you impressed when it comes to you mentioned the bones of the game? Like, what stands mm-hmm. out? What qualities?
The movement in the last couple of years of COD, we've just kind of felt on skates. I know multiple times I've mentioned it feels like ice skating through sludge, the current Call of Duty movement. Like you're slick, but it's not precise. With Battlefield, everything is, I always feel in control of my character. I love that. The gun mechanics as well. Each gun, if you go back to Modern Warfare 2019, each gun was very unique and had like a special sound, a special recoil pattern. These feel the same, where every single gun has its own uniqueness to it. The attachments matter. The bloom makes sense. Bloom is not something that I've been a huge fan of in past games, but it also increases your survivability drastically. So currently in COD, you run out in the middle of this. You try to cross the street 40 meters from somebody, and with the level of aim assist, you just get melted. Can't even move. They don't even have to, they could be a 50-year-old dad sitting on their couch playing on a 72-inch TV and it just laser you, not miss a single shot. And in this game with the bloom, that's not the case. Your survivability goes up drastically, which I think increases the immersiveness for sure, and adds a level of suspense when you know that you can make it across. You get taken to 1 HP, bullets are flying behind you. Like, it's not just an instant death every single time that you cross the street. It's nice.
Well, that was the thing that I loved so much during the COD era of Iron Trials, where it was like with the slower TTK, it was just like felt. It just, especially as fast as the TTK normally is in that game, it just feels more immersive. Longer battles, more intense battles. I mean, I think that was my peak of enjoying Warzone. And so I do think there's an element of that in Battlefield as well. As a controller player, I definitely did feel quite a bit less aim assist in Battlefield. Yep. So you use your right thumb there, Kev. I know. I think weekend two, I started to get my controller settings dialed in a bit. I was feeling better shooting. I did some of the practice modes against the bots, and just to get the feel, get reps in, and it felt good. And I actually went back to Warzone after, and I felt like it helped me out having less aim assist in one game. I was shredding day one, day two back on Warzone with the sticky aim assist on there. You know, I think, you know, when it comes to weekend one, weekend two, J-God posted a meme that, you know, the Drake meme, you see the meme on screen. Battlefield 6 beta week one, people were happy. Week two, people weren't as happy. Why was this a thing? Like, did you sense this at all or experience this? Because I felt the same to me weekend one to weekend two.
Yeah, I felt the same. I actually started playing PUBG the last couple of days of the weekend, even though Battlefield was available to play. I loved the game. I kept on having to tell people, like, why are you not on Battlefield? It's like, I love the game. It's just, it's a multiplayer. That's what I have to keep on reminding people. Like, there's only so much replayability when you have, what, four maps, five at most, with really two enjoyable game modes. It's very limited. And then in those maps, you're playing the same type of ways. Like, really, the breakthrough, I think, was the game mode. You either get stuck at A by a team that's way better than you, top to bottom, or you just roll through them and get stuck at certain points. And then after doing that 3-4 times, you're like, okay, I'm ready for a new experience. So it's multiplayer. It being a multiplayer and not a battle royale is really the only reason I feel like people were like, week two.
Yeah, I've got a hard time playing any multiplayer at all. It's battle royale and that's about it. I can't even play like single player games anymore. I can't. I tried playing Red Dead 2. I can't do it anymore. I hope I'm able to enjoy GTA 6 when that comes out. I'm sure I'll enjoy GTA. But battle royales are what I want to play, and that's why with Battlefield 6, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm not like all the way optimistic because I got to see the way they actually execute the battle royale. And I mean, they talk about having like a firestorm, like there's gonna be some differences, of course, from what we're used to the past 4 years with COD, but I do hope they take elements of, you know, PUBG, you know, watching you play that, but I'm hopeful, but there's no guarantees there. One thing I do want to ask you about, Iron, is like, how do you think the destruction of buildings is gonna change strategy when it comes to holding power spots in a Battlefield 6 battle royale?
That's what makes me most excited, actually. It changes everything that we think that we know about power positions in a battle royale. Like, typically it's always been, well, especially with recons, do a couple recons, get to center position, set up, and then kind of go from there. But now, like, the plays that you're gonna be able to make with people that are already in those power positions, or creating your own hardcover in fields with like tossing nades on the ground and creating like little foxholes, like that changes absolutely everything. You don't need all the smokes in the world, like Helmazra. That was just not a fun experience. If you don't have 15 smokes in the middle of the desert, you're just dead. Yeah, that's no longer the case. So the destructible environments changes everything. And that's, people talk about tanks in the Battlefield VR. I believe that tanks are going to be like a confirmed thing. You're not going to be able, I would imagine, like, I don't have any insider information, but just like kind of going through it in my head, there's no way you're going to be able to just land on a tank, start driving around and murking everyone. It's probably going to have to be a contract that you do, and then a coordinated team. Like, if you just go to the multiplayer, it's very easy to kill a tank if you have two or three engineers. I would imagine it's going to be the exact same way in the VR, where if you see a tank rolling away from, or rolling up from 500 meters out, you set up in some sneaky spots. As soon as it gets within 50 meters, everyone launches RPGs. You have C4 traps set. A tank's gone in 2 seconds. So I wouldn't really worry about tanks completely controlling the entire battlefield. I think that those will be more of a, someone's in a strong spot. Like, let's say there's an extremely powerful building that everyone knows is power position. You see them there. You know, eventually in 4 minutes, you're going to have to take that building from them or move past it. You go, you say, we're not taking this fight right now. We're going to go do the contract, get the tank, then come back with the tank and blow up that building. I think that's how tanks are going to be used in the VR. So being terrified of them being in one, it's not going to be a roll around, destroy everyone. It's going to be a destroy hardcover, blow through walls. That's how it's going to be utilized, I believe, in the battle royale.
I mean, I think that's one of the things I'm most excited about with it, with the potential of it, because, you know, when I watch streamers or when I play myself, like, it's fun to, you know, run and gun and all that, but I love the strategic element most of these games, like picking the right rotation, you know, having the right idea, choosing the right power position in order to optimize your chances of winning the game, deciding when to push, how to push, and everything else like that. And I think with Battlefield 6, I think their battle royale, once it's out, you know, what is it, March 2026, it's just seems to me it's going to be like different levels, different layers to that, considering the nature of that game. I think still like the map is going to matter. That's always going to matter. I think some of the little things that they add in there, like they do have COD devs that they hired that are running Battlefield 6, isn't going to be too much COD, or is it gonna, are they going to take elements from other games? It does feel like, though, you know, with the game they came out with, some of the Battlefield truthers are like, well, this is too much like COD. I feel like the devs that they hired from COD have found a nice middle ground where it's a lot of Battlefield and a little bit of COD. Is there anything you're concerned about with it, Iron? Any worries after the beta?
Only thing that comes to mind is it's going to be a typical mouse and keyboard player complaint in here. But there's been confirmed like less bloom on controller. That's been confirmed.
Really?
Less bloom
Wait
on controller.
Yeah, less I'm dead bloom serious. On controller? How,
which is
what?
A big deal. I don't know. That's a big deal, though. So it's going
so,
to have to
so
figure
less,
out. So like,
less aim assist and less bloom for controller players and more bloom for mouse and key.
Yeah, the less bloom is a good thing for accuracy, though. Less bloom is a really good thing for accuracy. So it still is like a... We'll see which advantage or which ranges, I guess, that less bloom is most noticeable. But that is kind of like a red flag that I'll wave right away. Also, like you mentioned it before, like it is possible for them to mess up the Battle Royale. And they did create Firestorm, EA, with Battlefield 5, I believe it was. And Firestorm's looting was, I thought, so bad that I didn't even give it a legit chance after a week. So that company has messed up a VR in the past. It is possible, but you were saying the COD dev that they brought in, he also made Apex, I believe, and Titanfall. So the dude really knows what he's doing.
Yes.
In Modern Warfare 2019 and Warzone. So that gives me a ton of confidence. So a little worried? Yes. Extremely optimistic? Absolutely. Like this is the most hyped I've been for a game since Modern Warfare 2019, easily.
Do you think there's any chance, you know, we were talking earlier about the Sixers. I'm continuing to trust the process. Do you have any trust remaining at all in Activision to save COD here? Like, do you think there's any chance they're stepping their game up?
I've talked about this a little bit. Their best bet, I don't think that currently they have any trust from the player base. The trust is completely gone. It's kind of like a meme at this point. Like, you want to see what they're doing, just look at the store. They're not putting much effort into the game. but their creative department in the store is top tier. But sure like is. Moving forward, it really
store's
is.
Store's always
forward,
working, Iron, right? Store's always open.
They'll shut down the world if the store stops working. But I think their best path forward is to do like go back to their roots and what they used to do so well, which is make a very good multiplayer experience. Like growing up, Modern Warfare, the original one, Modern Warfare 2, Modern Warfare 3. I liked, you know, there's so many good CODs that we can all list off here. And they were fun multiplayer experiences for whatever reason. In my opinion, since 2019, I know I'm not a big multiplayer fan, but I loved Modern Warfare 2019. They have just kind of, the quality's gone downhill. I think that they go back to the basics, make a good bare bones game. Don't focus on Warzone. Don't focus on Resurgence. Don't focus on an extraction mode. Do what you do best. Earn back the trust of the player base. Then in 2 years, when everyone's complaining about the Battlefield Battle Royale, inevitably, then they can come and be the saviors. You know, don't try to compete with a company who pumped $400 million into their game and is clearly trying to upend you. Like, they're not, I don't really feel like they're built for that type of competition right now. I think they go back to their roots, build back the trust slowly but surely, and then come back in a couple years and come out with like a Blackout 2. That, I believe, is their best path forward.
It's a shame, man. I mean, when Verdansk came back, I felt like Warzone was back. Like, the audio was, at least in my opinion, arguably better than ever, or at least better than it's been in many years. And it's like, don't touch the game. Don't touch it. No more updates. Don't touch it. Leave it as is. I'll play it forever. And then every update, the audio's gotten worse. Something's gotten screwed up. It's like, here we go again. It's such a bummer, man. The game, when Call of Duty Warzone's good, it's amazing. Yeah. But it's just, I don't know what they do, man, especially with the audio aspect. It just gets worse every single update.
They got to be so spread thin over there, like making sure that the game is functioning with all of the new like stuff they're adding from the store and all the new events. They have to be short on something to allow the audio to get worse and worse and allow the bugs to get worse and worse. The hackers, same thing. Like, because the stuff that they do focus on, the store, right? The events, all that stuff is always smooth. So you know that they know what they're doing in some regards. So I don't think they have enough manpower or something.
Yeah, man, I'm not sure if it's I don't know if it's the more incompetent or lack of bodies or some mixture of both, but I do know it's lack of bodies, that's for sure. But they launched great. Verdansk relaunched beautifully. So there's something there. It was awesome. Yep. There's something there, but we'll see if they can actually get back to that. With that said, though, I've been watching you almost for 4 years now. Have been, enjoyed many hours watching you play Warzone. I think one of my favorite Iron memories is the long win streak you went on after your daughter was born. How long was that win streak?
82 games in Caldera.
82. That was right after your daughter was born, right?
If I remember correctly. right around that time period. Yeah,
that's crazy. What's your favorite Warzone memory over the last 4 years?
Oh, there's so many good ones. Yeah, there's so many good ones. Definitely the very, very first tournament where we won the first ever Warzone tournament. We won the first ever game, and it was a prison end game, and we just played it textbook. Textbook. No one stood a chance.
Top
best
four,
players in the world.
Top four towers. Is that where you were?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right on top of prison. No one stood a chance. We picked everyone apart. Easy peasy. And then everyone, I remember after that first game, was just like, just give Iron the tournament right now. We ended up getting third, but that was an amazing memory, winning the very first Warzone game and the very first tournament ever. There's some like beating cheaters is some of the best memories. Just like absolute rage hackers with 70 KDs shooting us through buildings for 10 minutes. Beating those guys is super satisfying. Screw those dudes.
Biggest losers on the planet.
Yeah, screw those dudes, man. But yeah, there's so many good memories. But I would have to say that one, winning the first game of the first tournament, never forget that.
That's awesome. And to make it even better, I love a good prison ending. That's my favorite place for a prison ending.
It's the best.
Stay top four, snipe all game. It's fun.
With my claymores, I'm always safe. Like,
it's the best. It is the best. And I still enjoy playing the game. I'm hopeful, not optimistic, but I'm hopeful that they're able to improve things. But at the least, March 2026, we get something very, very, very good to look forward to with Battlefield 6. Are you going to play a lot of Battlefield 6 multi until March 2026? Or are you going to still be sticking with other games until then? Because I can't do multi. I can't.
Yeah. I'm going to treat it just like I treated Modern Warfare 2019, where I'm trying to like master all of the mechanics. So learn all the guns, all the recoil patterns, all the maps, the building destruction. Because as soon as the Battle Royale hits, I want to be able to jump right into it and not miss a single beat, not be fumbling over what's this do, how do I blow up this building, the weak points of the building. So I'll definitely be playing the multiplayer, but I'm not going to play it like 70 hours a week. I'll probably put 20, 30, make sure that I really understand the mechanics, and then probably play a lot of PUBG, a little bit of Warzone. But PUBG, I'm a little superstitious with this. Before Modern Warfare 2019, I grinded PUBG, like grinded it on PC. And I feel like my aim got significantly better. If you ever played PUBG, there's no aim assist on controller. And if you like try to shoot a 30-round mag in your AK, you have to pull down like 5-6 inches on the mouse to control the recoil somewhat. Like, a significant amount of skill is required. So I feel like me playing PUBG helps my mouse and keyboard skills the best, so that when Battlefield 6 hits, I'll be ready to hit the ground running.
We'll be right back. And usually I'm in chat. We're not talking face-to-face, talking NBA in your chat. I'm curious, Iron, what do you think right now? State of the Western Conference, is there a team in like these non-playoff teams from last year that you're most excited to watch this coming season? I have a feeling I know who you're going to say, though.
Yeah, you already know. I mean, I'm a huge Wemby fan. Huge Wemby fan. I've been a LeBron fan for 20 years, and the last few years I've not really enjoyed his best, like watching him play as much, which is expected. I mean, he's in year 45, you know, what are you going to do? But when Wemby came along, the Spurs finally putting the pieces around him, I'm very, very excited to see if they got the right roster and if he can make somehow another jump into a different stratosphere and become that top five MVP caliber every single year.
Before his career started, I said that I felt like year three for him would be his MVP season. I think it's probably 1 year too soon for that this year. The defense is there already. Offensively, it would have to be a massive leap. I just think with the Spurs roster, the guys that they have, the ball handlers that they have, it's probably more like a year or two from now. I don't think they're going to quite put the ball in his hands yet to be the primary creator with all the guys.
Yeah, yeah, you said it. Getting Dylan Harper, trading for Fox, like, there's just so many. And then what Castle did with Wemby out last year, he became a primary ball handler at times and showed he could be a creator. So they have a lot of potential playmakers on that team. I'm interested to see what you think would be a potential lineup that would work with Fox, because when they got Fox, I loved the fit initially, but them getting the second pick with Harper, I was just kind of, the more I watch Harper, the more I fall in love with his game. He's so, so smooth. I could see him at the end of his first year being one of the perennial, like, best drivers to the basket in the NBA. He's so good with the ball in his hands. Then what do you do with Fox, you know? So I'm just wondering what lineup do you think they could put together on the floor with all the weapons that they have and still utilizing Wemby at the level that they could, that would actually get them over that hump with Wemby taking that next step?
Like, the optimal lineup with those three together, I think one of them is going to have to try to be like their new Manu Ginobili, like being like a super sixth man. Like, you're able to stagger those guys rather than using all three of them at once. Unless there's a world in which, like, Harper becomes a knockdown guy, or Fox takes another leap as a shooter, or Castle, things click for him. And so I think having one of them, ideally his rookie year, it's easy to say, Harper, you're going to come off the bench this year and you're going to stagger as much as possible with Fox. I think having two of those guys on the floor for the Spurs this year, the objective is to take a step. It's to get into the playoffs. It's to be one of the top eight seeds and to get those playoff reps for the young guys. So I think having Fox and Castle in the starting five together with as many shooters as possible at the three and four spots next to Wemby, I think is optimal. But long term, obviously you hope Harper becomes a star. It could become a good problem to have if you have all of those guys on the roster at once. But I just hope they put the right supporting pieces around him in the same way that we saw OKC do with SGA, where it's like they're loaded aside from SGA. And, you know, like, the NBA puts the Spurs on Christmas Day against Oklahoma City. They're trying to push the Chet versus Wemby rivalry, trying to push OKC, San Antonio. But San Antonio is years behind what OKC already has. And I think with them, you know, maybe there's also going to be like a little bit of a, they might miss Chris Paul a little bit, you know, because, you know, Chris Paul and Wemby had instant chemistry. Fox and Wemby didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. They were, a net negative by a couple points, I believe, when they were on the floor together in the limited time that they had. But yeah, it's going to take a little bit for them to click. But I guess that's probably kind of expected as well.
Sure.
We'll see what they can do.
I think of those non-playoff teams in the Western Conference, the Mavericks, they're probably the one that, like, has a chance to take the biggest leap. Obviously, of course, they trade Luka, they get Anthony Davis, but they still have a really good team on paper. And then they luck out and they get Cooper Flagg.
Luck out is the understatement of the century. My goodness.
Do you think there's any chance, Iron, that Nico Harrison has proven right? Any chance of it?
There's definitely a chance. His job might have been saved by that 1% chance, you know. Holy cow. I've been big on Flagg since I saw him in high school. I remember saying on stream, as soon as he signed to Duke, I was like, if you're a betting man, put money on Duke for the national championship right now. I was a little off, but still, like, he just influences winning in every single way. You could put Flagg on any team in the NBA, and I feel like he's an instant contributor to that team winning basketball. So you put AD, a healthy AD, a healthy Kyrie, if they're on the floor together in the playoffs and playing as well as they can, even both of them in their 30s at this point, like, I mean, that's prime nowadays. So with Flagg kind of rounding that corner at the end of his rookie year, they could be a dangerous team come playoff time if they peak at that right time, for sure. Huge Flagg, yeah, man.
Definitely. I mean, Flagg's awesome. He's a New England boy like me. So I love him, especially for that reason, from Maine. But I think with Flagg, man, you mentioned, like, there's no questions. I think he's going to be a productive rookie. I think I have no questions. He's going to be a productive defensive player. He knows where to be and when to be on defense. Offensively, he developed a shot last year at Duke. He became a 80-plus percent guy from the free throw line, became a near 40% guy from three. I have no questions about his ability to hit spot-up jumpers and to attack closeouts and just play in, like, different roles, plug and play. I think with Dallas, it's kind of the opposite, where it's like, well, the question with them is, what are the stars going to look like? You have Kyrie Irving out with a torn ACL right now. You have AD. You're saying, if you get healthy AD. AD's been healthier in recent years for the Lakers, but then last year he has the major injury. He has this dominant first half with the Mavericks, and then he's knocked out for almost the remainder of the season. And, like, there's no guarantee with any big, you know, on the wrong side of 30. And with AD, that's a big question. But I think with, look, like, Nico made a dumb decision trading Luka. Like, that I think it's a dumb decision, period. But I think you can hold that opinion of him while also acknowledging that I get what he's going for. I get what he's going for with this big, long-armed, positionless defense. Like, you saw it, like, last year with AD out there with Derek Lively and PJ Washington and Klay Thompson around Kyrie. Like, that's a big freaking team. And so I think with them, they could be dominant defensively. And if Kyrie comes back healthy, if Flagg is really good as a rookie, if D'Angelo Russell, like, you know, holds down the fort in the time that Kyrie's out, there's a chance they're, like, really, really good, man. Like, they could be top four, top five seed, but it's just so many ifs. It's so many ifs, and there's so many teams in the West that you have more certainty about.
I had a question for you as far as the Eastern Conference non-playoff teams, kind of like we asked on the West side. Anyone that you think stands out that can make a major leap, a big addition that they made, or someone ready to take that next step?
It might be silly to say. A lot of people probably, you know, might roll their eyes when I say it, but I'm excited to watch the Sixers, man. I still love Joel Embiid. I still believe in Joel Embiid. I think the roster around him just makes all the sense in the world.
With trust the process, you know?
I'm still trusting the process. I've been burned so many times, but I'm still trusting the process. Maybe I shouldn't trust it anymore, but I just think, like, the Sixers young players are so freaking good, man. Jared McCain was so good as a rookie before he got hurt. This year, draft VJ Edgecombe, it feels like he makes sense next to Tyrese Maxey, who's emerging as an all-star caliber player. If Paul George can have a bounce back year, big if. If Joel Embiid can stay healthy, big if. I don't see why the Sixers can't be one of the contending teams in this wide open, weak Eastern Conference. It's just, like, these big, massive ifs. I just think, like, maybe it's just my upbringing, Iron, as, like, as a Boston sports fan. But when I was growing up, born in 1990, when I'm growing up, the Patriots were called the Patsies. The Celtics hadn't won since the 80s, and they had a miserable 90s. The Red Sox hadn't won when I'm growing up for over 80 years, curse of the Bambino. And then boom, like, it turns into decades of winning. Like, everybody won championships. Even the New England Revolution won championships. It wasn't just the Big Four with the Celtics, Patriots, Red Sox, and Bruins. The Revolution even won, for that matter, too. Like, it was just decades of winning. And so all that to say, like, for Sixers fans, they've just been miserable for so long. And so there's part of me with my upbringing that feels like, well, even though things are bad, it doesn't mean that they can't become good. And so I'm hopeful that Sixers fans get to at least get through round two of the playoffs for once during the Joel Embiid era. Am I crazy to still be trusting the process, Iron?
I don't think so. I have a similar type story and upbringing. I was a Detroit Lions fan. So I watched every single game of that 0-17 season, everyone. And then now all of a sudden we're winning, you know, we got a chance at a Super Bowl. So I'm big on Embiid as well. I like him quite a bit. I've been saying this for a while. A healthy Embiid on the offensive end especially is nearly unstoppable. Get him to the playoffs healthy, like 100%, and let's see what he can actually do. Because if he's rolling into the playoffs healthy, he'll just drop 40 and 50 all day long like he does in the regular season. If he would have been MVP, what, last year, 2 years ago? If he would have played as many games as he needed to, like, he was unstoppable.
Yeah, but I just, it's just such a big if. He's never been, he wasn't healthy when he entered the NBA. He hasn't been healthy throughout. I just hope he doesn't go down as one of those great players that just never could stay on the floor. But I don't know. I'm hopeful he can have one of those years. That's all it takes. Just 1 year staying healthy and your team has a chance. Appreciate you joining me today, man. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you. Thanks for always hanging out, for having me here. Very grateful for this. You're awesome, man.
Appreciate it, Aaron. Have a good day, man.
You as well.
Big thank you to Iron and Matt Harmon for joining me today. Thanks to Emmy and Dakota for producing us. Thanks to Father John and Misty for the music. We'll be back next week with more pods. Have a good weekend.